Secretary Sophia Tenney and our LIO moderator Nate Williams for helping us with behind-the-scenes work here for our committee today. As we start, I want to remind committee members to please put your phones on silent. And in the room today, we have Representative Rauscher and myself, Chair Schrage, expecting to be joined by others here shortly. Today, back before us, we have House Bill 299, Microreactors by the Governor. This is the second hearing on HB 299. Today, the committee will hear a presentation from the Nuclear Energy Institute. And not seeing any questions, but I would note that Representative Kaufman has joined us at 10:18. Not seeing any immediate questions or items before the committee, I'd like to welcome to the committee Mark Nickel, Senior Director of New Reactors for the Nuclear Energy Institute. Before we start the presentation, just for the committee members to take note, we'll take questions at the end of each slide. So, Mr. Nichols, if you could please pause at the end of each slide so that members can have an opportunity to raise their hand and ask questions. If you could please put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My pleasure and honor to be able to speak with you today. The Nuclear Energy Institute is the trade association for the nuclear energy industry. We represent companies in the nuclear industry before the federal, states, and regulators. My position is Senior Director of New Reactors. With that, I lead industry's efforts to deploy advanced nuclear reactors. Any questions before I move on to the next slide?
No, please proceed. And if you'd like to just note what slide you're on, that'll help us keep on track with you.
Great. I'm on slide. This is Mark Nickel again. I'm on slide two. I want to start just by giving an overview of the markets for microreactors. There are two types of microreactors, stationary and mobile. Primarily, we're talking about stationary reactors today, which are reactors that would stay in their location for the entire time of their operating life. A mobile reactor could move to a different or even several locations over its lifetime. The most important thing to point out here is that of these market opportunities or applications for microreactors in the stationary area, I believe all of them exist in Alaska, whether it's remote villages, mining operations, defense installations, even microgrids. Microreactors are great opportunities or solutions for their clean and resilient energy needs. Any questions on this slide?
Not seeing any. Please proceed.
All right, great. Mark Nickel again on slide three. I want to cover the breadth of designs in the microreactor area. There are over a dozen companies working on microreactor designs. This is a list of many of them, but not all of them. You may be familiar with some companies. Oklo has been in the licensing process with the NRC. UltraSafe Nuclear just made an announcement with Copper Valley there in Alaska recently. And other companies as well are being active in both engagement with potential customers as well as engagement with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the licensing and approval of their designs. A microreactor is generally 1 to 10 megawatts of electric in size. They can be larger than that, up to 50 megawatt electric as the legislation identifies. Any questions on this slide?
Not seeing any. Please proceed.
Great. Mark Nickel again. I want to cover the deployment timeline. So we get primarily three questions when we talk about microreactors. When will they be ready and how long do they take to deploy? The second question is how much do they cost? And then the third question is usually around some considerations of, regulatory process or something. So the first one on how long will it take for these to be deployed, I have two slides. The first slide gives a general timeline for a project, and this happens to be a first-of-a-kind project. This comes from a report we put together a few years ago for the Department of Defense as they were starting to look at microreactors. And we laid out all of the critical activities that are needed to go from considering a microreactor to actually producing power. And it begins, obviously, with the customer making a decision that this is the solution that they want, and then entering into a contract with a provider. And then it goes through, you need to develop a license application, you need to go through the NRC licensing process. There is some parallel work that can be done in manufacturing the product. And then you have to go through construction and site work after the NRC approval, and then finally startup. So this schedule, what we found is we had estimated nominally 7 years. It could be as fast as 5 years, or could even take a little longer than that. What we found since 2018 is that many of the assumptions we made have turned out to be very conservative, and we knew that going in. We knew that microreactors have an opportunity to have much shorter timelines than other advanced nuclear reactors. And what we've seen over those 4 years is that we've been making progress in reducing the timelines to deploying a microreactor. Some of those have come on the licensing side. Some have come in the supply chain area. And so this graph I show here is a five-year timeline. We are also working at shortening that timeline even further, and the goal would be that after the first of a kind, some years down the road, we could deploy these in as little as 3 years or maybe even less. Any questions on this slide?
We do, and I'd like to note that Representative Klayman joined us at 10:23, and we have a question from Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Nichols. Just curious, the deployment timeline, I guess this assumes maturity of designs and certification of basic designs. So this is this timeline is accurate. Should we have a design that's mature enough to be deployed? And assuming that we have a population of devices, reactors that are at that level of maturity that could conform to this timeline? Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Mark Nichol. Yes, that's correct. That this is built on an assumption that the technology was mature enough to deploy. The technology mature would have to be mature enough when you go to sign the contract. And so that would be the point at which you would verify that. There are several designs that are at that point that are mature enough to sign the contract. Some have gone out and done testing and other work to validate parts of the design, and so that is important as well. The next slide, I'll actually cover where some of the designs are in their deployment of a first reactor.
Follow up, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. And I guess the schedule item that is not apparent here, but of course is inherent, is site selection. So okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, I look forward to the rest of the presentation. Thanks.
Please continue.
Mark Nichol again. Thank you. So slide five now is the current state of demonstrations for several of the designs. All of these that are listed here are planned to be online between 2025 and 2027. So I'll go through a couple of these. Oklo is a microreactor that was shown on one of the earlier slides. They have plans to operate their first microreactor in Idaho. It would be at the Idaho National Laboratory, and they're a 1.5 megawatt reactor. They're working with INL on getting access to fuel there as well as access to the site to be able to operate it. And my understanding is that all of these would be the commercial version of the reactor. UltraSafe Nuclear has announced two demonstrations. The first one would be in Canada, actually, at Chalk River, the national laboratory there. They're working with in a consortium called Global First, and that is with the utility Ontario Power Generation, and that is part of a sort of government-backed demonstration program there. The second demonstration that they're working on is with the University of Illinois, obviously in Illinois. The university there wants to use a microreactor to produce power and heat for the university's needs, but also is available to provide testing and research functions for the university. They have a nuclear engineering program there. There are two demonstrations being developed by the Department of Defense. The first one is with the Air Force, and the Air Force has announced that Eielson Air Force Base will be the site of this microreactor by 2027. My understanding is that they're still on schedule to release a request for proposal here in February with a goal of selecting a design by the end of the year. The other one, sorry, I skipped over it, but it's the Department of Defense for a mobile microreactor. This would be one that's more movable. And they are working with two companies right now, X-Energy and BWXT, and they're planning to select which of those designs they'll proceed with constructing here in the spring, assuming that they get appropriate funding from the government on their demonstration this year, they'll actually begin construction activities for that. And that'll also be in Idaho National Laboratory. Any questions on this slide?
Representative Fields joined us at 10:29 a.m. And Representative Rauscher, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Department of Defense, what's the purpose? What are they going to use the reactor for? Do you have any idea?
So the Eielson Air Force Base, I think it's to demonstrate the ability of a microreactor to provide resilient power to the base to allow them to be able to decouple from the grid when they need to, and also provide enhanced protection against cyber security threats as well as other security threats. That's the stationary one at Eielson Air Force Base. The mobile one, which is it's being developed by the Strategic Capabilities Office at DOD. They're somewhat like a research arm of DOD. That is to demonstrate proof of technology so that a mobile microreactor could be placed into one of the services. For example, it might be the Army, and they could develop a program where they would actually utilize mobile reactors overseas.
Follow up. And were both of those supposed to come online by 27, did you say, or was that just the one?
The Alaska at Eielson Air Force Base is scheduled by 2027. The mobile reactor demonstration at Idaho, they're looking, I think right now it's 2025.
I'm not seeing any other questions at the moment. Please continue.
Of course.
All right. Thank you. On to slide six. Mark Nickel again. So this is an overview of the cost estimates and cost competitiveness of microreactors. There's a lot on the graph, so let me explain it. The colored bars going crosswise represent the current costs of generating electricity in various markets. Now, when I say generating electricity, it's not the full cost to the customer because it doesn't include transmission costs or other overhead costs of the business. And then within generating costs, one thing that we looked at is specifically in the remote Arctic communities, but in some of the others, is when we compare against diesel generation costs today, we did not include the capital cost of the diesel generator or the O&M cost. We only compared it against the fuel cost. And that fuel cost is, one, the fuel itself, the diesel fuel, but also the transportation of that fuel to the location. That's why you see the remote Arctic community in green there is such a large zone is because the transportation costs vary depending on the location. So we have a couple of markets here, remote Arctic communities, remote defense installations is the purple. Blue is island communities and remote mining. The Alaska Rail Belt is in orange, and then at the bottom, the U.S. grid is in red. And then we have three lines across here representing the estimated costs of micro reactors. We have in the middle, the purple line is our expected, our best estimate cost. The red is a higher cost, and the blue is a lower cost. Primarily, these looked at variability in terms of what are we expecting for the capital cost of a microreactor, O&M cost for a microreactor. That places the initial cost point of the first reactor there on the left side of those. And so you can see the first reactors we're expecting to range from somewhere around 15 cents to 40 cents a kilowatt hour. And then from there, the x-axis goes along the line of as you deploy more reactors, the prices come down. It's a well-known phenomenon. Every time you double the number of units that you produce, the price goes down by a certain percentage. And so we estimated, well, at the higher cost, let's assume you get a lower learning rate, so just 5% reduction every doubling. And then in the at the lowest cost, you get the best learning rate. And so you get 15% cost reduction every doubling. And then the middle is sort of in between there. And those numbers are supported not just by what we've experienced internationally with multiple nuclear builds of large plants, but also what's it experienced in other industries as well for manufacturing. And so what this does is it gives a good band of, well, here's what we expect to be the very lowest, and here's what we expect to be the very highest. And then the middle, obviously, is the best estimate. And it gives an idea of the question, can these be competitive in the market? And so the answer, or the conclusion here is that, yes, in fact, even at the highest cost, the very first one is competitive in many markets. It may just be remote Arctic communities where the cost of transporting fuel is the highest, but certainly it will automatically reduce the cost in there. And then if we can do even better, if we can achieve the lower cost and higher learning rates, then we might even be competitive in the Alaska Rail Belt with the micro reactors. So that's really encouraging to see that it has that potential. And this is, it's important to note here that this is without government support for first-of-a-kind technologies. What we're seeing with the larger advanced reactors is that they're a little bit more expensive than the lowest price in the market, and so we need some federal support, and we're getting federal support to help spur a first-of-a-kind adoption. What we see with micro reactors is that even without that government support, they're automatic, or they're already having an opportunity to reduce the cost of power. And so obviously, if governments wanted to support and help defray some of the first-of-a-kind costs, that it would spur adoption even more quickly. But what we're seeing here is that we do think that there's a private-only possibility of deploying micro reactors. Any questions on this slide?
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you again through the chair. I appreciate the slide, but could you give me the definition of learning rate?
Yeah, the learning rate is how much percentage the cost decreases every time you double the production. So let's just say it was $100. The first one was $100. And you have a 10% learning rate, then when you produce the second one, it goes down to $90. When you produce the fourth one, it goes down another 10%. When you produce the eighth one, it goes down another 10%, and so on and so on.
Thank you. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
So can you explain to me why it goes down?
Yeah, through the chair, this is Mark Nickel again. It goes down for a number of reasons. It's as you learn how to do it, you get to do it more efficiently. So if you think of any task that you might do, the first time there's a lot of figuring out how to do it. How are you going to put it together? How do you get the process set up? So it takes a lot more time and cost and to do that. As you do it a few more times, you get really good at it, and you just can do it a lot faster. So time has a large amount to play with in this. And then you can also figure out how to do it more efficiently. Well, I went and produced the component through all these five or six steps, but I figured out I could actually do it through two or three steps. And so you eliminate, again, time, but also the man hours that go into it.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
I was wondering, so you have a kilowatt cost per hour, is that correct, on the left side? And
yes.
I was wondering, is that indefinitely going to cost that much? Sooner or later, the reactor's paid off.
So this is a levelized cost of electricity. It's the average cost over the lifetime of the plant. So it combines the O&M cost and fuel costs, which are more annual costs, with the capital cost, which is amortized or spread over the entire life of the plant. So, if you look at it as the cost on day one and everything, when you're still paying off the financing of the capital, you'll have a little bit higher cost there than after you've paid off the capital cost.
Follow up, Representative Rauscher, you clearly have an interest in nuclear energy.
So do you have any idea about how much it's going to cost to run one of these on a yearly basis? Let's say it's 10, and I'm sure there's some mathematical formula, whether it's a 10 megawatt or it's a 5 megawatt or it's a 1 or it's a 20. Just a number, 10 megawatt, what is it going to cost to run one of those a year? Do you have any ideas or a formula out there? Is
sure.
there a mathematical chart they give the people who want to purchase one? This is an idea of what it's going to cost you to run, and if so, can you give us an idea of what that is?
Yeah, through the chair, Mark Nicol again. We do. It's in the report. I'd have to go to the report to recall the numbers on the annual cost of the reactor. I do remember the upfront cost, and that would be for a micro reactor in this size range. We're talking on the order of $100 million to purchase the reactor, and then there would be annual operating cost on top of that. But I can get you the exact numbers. It's in this report that's referenced here.
Okay, if you could provide that for the community, that would be good.
Very good.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Any other questions from the committee at the moment? Not seeing any. Please continue.
Okay. Mark Nicol again. On to slide 7. I have two more slides that look at the cost to just break down a little bit in terms of understanding how different parameters influence the cost. This first slide 7 is on the ownership of the microreactor. What we find is that investor owners pay higher cost in financing the interest rates and cost of capital than publicly owned utilities like cooperatives or municipal utilities. And so there is a slight difference in the cost between that. But what we also find is that if the federal government has loan guarantees available for nuclear projects, and so if an investor-owned owner utilizes the loan guarantees, then they can reduce the financing interest rates to be very similar to what a publicly owned utility would be. So now there are slight differences based on the ownership structure, but you can get the cost fairly close, independent of what the ownership structure is. The good part of this is that it allows a lot of different business models. So for a utility that wants to own it, and they're publicly owned, or even if they want to get a loan guarantee, if they're not, they can experience about the same costs. And if a utility doesn't want to own it, they just want to pay for the power through a power purchase agreement, and they have the developer or somebody else own it for them, then they can still get about the same cost of power by that arrangement as well. Any questions?
Not seeing any. Please continue.
All right, Mark Nickel again. Slide 8. The second factor is whether you use the micro reactor all the time or whether you cycle it on and off or at high power and low power frequently. And what we know is a micro reactor is a high capital cost, very low O&M and fuel cost. And so what that means is the more you use it, the more you can spread the capital cost and bring the actual price of the levelized cost of electricity down. And so what we see here is at a 95% capacity factor, this is using it almost all the time at 100% power, you get the lowest cost. And then if you use it about half of the time, 50% of the time, the costs are a lot more than that, almost double. And but the other interesting thing is that if you look at this, well, you can go down to 75% capacity factor with only a modest impact on the cost of that electricity. So it does offer an opportunity to cycle it, to flex it, to meet, go up and down to meet load demand. But the other thing that the industry is looking at is, well, could we do that? Could we add in flexibility to cycle based on the load profile, but it at the same time also operated at 100% power all the time? And so what companies are looking at are, we call them hybrid or hybrid energy systems. And so it would pair a micro reactor that produces electricity with the ability to produce heat. So it can produce heat and electricity for the needs, switching between the two, so it's always operating at full power. It could have a heat storage system added to it, so when it's producing more than demand, it stores up it charges up the heat energy system, and when the demand is higher than the output, it can retrieve energy from that storage system. And then the other thing we're looking at is, well, maybe we can produce hydrogen or other synthetic fuels to be able to decarbonize those fuels. Any questions on this slide?
Yes, Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. My understanding is that the ultra-safe nuclear proposal for Valdez, Copper River Valley, would provide, it sounds like, about half the electricity because they'd be using hydro in the summer, basically micro reactor in the winter. 20 cents a kilowatt hour is on the low end, seems lower than these. Is that only possible because they're also using heat to heat the terminal, and that's kind of built into the cost calculus? Does this suggest that the ultra-safe nuclear price point is a pretty good price point, given how new the technology is? Just curious about your take on that project, to the extent you're aware of it, in the context of this broader price curve.
Yeah, through the chair, Mark Nickel again. So I have not seen the details of the ultra-safe cost analysis, so I can't remark specifically on where their numbers are. But I can say that when we put together this analysis, we did get input from developers. They gave us their estimates. And we added a lot of conservatism in there because the last thing we wanted is to come in with a report that had very low price estimates and then come to find out later the actual price is much higher. So it does not surprise me that there are companies out there with their specific analysis of their design which shows costs less than this. And then I defer other questions on that to UltraSafe.
Thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
All right, Mark Nickel again, on to slide 9. This picks up on the heat side of things, and it does it by way of using hydrogen as a proxy. This study that was done by Lucid Catalyst looked at, well, how much does it cost to produce hydrogen from various energy sources? And if you look at solar and wind and other sources that would be clean electricity, they're doing it by electricity, and so that's very well and good. Nuclear can also produce hydrogen through electricity, but what we're finding is that if you produce hydrogen with heat or even heat-assisted electricity, then the costs come down quite a bit. So in this clean heat category over here, what you'll find is that those points with the lowest cost for producing hydrogen are all based on nuclear technology. Now, none of those are a microreactor. Where microreactors would fall, it's not quite certain, but it would be somewhere in that range. And so if we just use production of hydrogen as a proxy of producing heat, then you can see that nuclear offers a very competitive cost on heat. Any questions?
Not seeing any. Please continue.
All right. Thank you, Mark Nicola, again. On slide 10, I wanted to talk about what is the utility and state interest in advanced nuclear generally, microreactors specifically. We talked a lot about Alaska and appreciate the House's interest in microreactors and the bill that we're discussing. There are a lot of other states that have made policy changes to help support advanced reactors in a couple of different ways. There are states that have repealed what we would call moratoriums. They're essentially rules that make it more difficult to or prohibit the deployment of nuclear in that state. Montana is an example of last year. They repealed the law that said that voters had to approve every single new nuclear site in their state. And West Virginia did the same thing just this month. And so there are states that are starting to repeal those moratoriums and allow projects to move forward, relying on the state agencies that are set up to regulate either environmental impacts or electricity costs. The other policy tools that have been passed, some have gone into study bills to look at what new nuclear advanced reactors looks like in their state and whether they're feasible and how they would go about it. Others have put into place even support mechanisms like tax incentives. What we find is that there's a correlation between state action or policies that support or enable advanced reactors and utility action to pursue it. Where states have policies that discourage or advanced reactors, there's not as much utility interest. Where states have actually policies that support and encourage advanced reactors, there's much more utility interest in those states. Any questions here?
Not seeing any questions at the moment.
All right. Thank you very much. That's my presentation, and you have my contact information.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nichols. Fascinating presentation, and we appreciate you appearing before the committee today. Are there any other questions from committee members before we wrap up here? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Nickel. In some reading I've done, and I don't know if you can comment, and feel free to pass on this, but the tale of two countries. So Germany has leaned towards what we think of as renewables, wind, solar, and all of that, while France has kind of anchored its power production more in atomic energy. And as a result, there's kind of a different energy security situation going on between those two countries where Germany may find itself on the ropes because it doesn't have the base production capacity that may be enhanced by renewables but isn't anchored by a more durable form. Have you observed that, and do you see any corollaries between how we might use these reactors versus some of the other what's thought of as green energy in terms of renewables? Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Mark Nickel. Yes, so first I just want to put out there that we see ourselves as partners with other clean energy sources. We see ourselves as partners with renewables, wind and solar, partners with gas and carbon capture sequestration, energy storage, all of those. We believe that the amount of energy, new sources of energy that are going to be needed to meet the goals that are being established has plenty of room for everybody. But I will also say that we also know that systems that include a diversified portfolio, including nuclear energy, have the lowest cost and best reliability of the systems. And so you correctly point out the tale of two countries over there, France, which would be a exporter of energy, high reliability and energy security, versus Germany, which would be an importer of energy, and some of that is even not clean energy that they're getting from other countries, and their energy security and reliability would be less. And there is a direct correlation between whether they have a healthy nuclear industry or whether they have decided to forego the benefits of nuclear energy.
Follow-up, Representative Coffin?
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Nicol. Yeah, I guess for me the lesson is optimize your selection and array of solutions against what's best for your region, area, your local conditions, et cetera. I just want to say also that the heat production, you know, the cogeneration potential, making power on one end and heat on the other with respect to hydrogen, that's pretty interesting. I've been reading about some solid-state storage methods of hydrogen for fuel cells that can be loaded by cartridges. And if we start having available hydrogen, that could be a pretty interesting source going forward.
All right, not seeing any other questions. Thank you again, Mr. Nicol. We appreciate having you here before the committee today. Just as a preview for committee members, this coming Tuesday, February 15th, we're going to have an introductory hearing on HB 247, Power Cost Equalization, by Representative Thompson, and be taking public testimony on this bill, HB 299. With that, not seeing anything else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 10:54 a.m.